From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, leaders across Europe are calling for stronger border controls and smaller refugee quotas. That's following Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris that left at least 129 people dead. Some leaders are proposing suspension of the Schengen Agreement, which allows passport-free travel in the European Union. And France, Belgium, and Italy have already enacted new border security measures. Meanwhile, governors of more than half of U.S. states announced Monday they will refuse to accept Syrian refugees. We'll bring you the latest developments. That's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The attacks in Paris that took at least 129 lives and injured hundreds have intensified the debate in Europe over border security. Concerns have escalated over refugees from Syria, and especially in light of the possibility that at least one of the Islamic State militants involved in the planning of the attack may have posed as a Syrian refugee. Thousands of migrants continue to arrive each day in Europe, and some have called for a suspension of the Schengen Agreement, which permits unrestricted passport travel throughout the EU. In the United States, the governors of more than half of the states, all but one of them Republicans, say they are opposed to letting Syrian refugees into their states. We turn our attention in this opening Forum Hour to the ongoing refugee crisis in the wake of Friday's terror attack on Paris. And we want to go first to London and welcome Paul Kirby, who is Europe editor for BBC News. Welcome, Paul Kirby. Glad to have you with us.
Hi there, Michael.
I guess the place to begin is just to talk about what kind of solidarity is holding here. It seems like the center will not hold, at least for the present, in terms of the wide range of responses throughout Europe on, well, both border controls, heightened security, and number of refugees to permit.
Yeah, that is certainly true. I mean, the migrant crisis that we've had really since the end of August that has been going on for many months, which you've seen more than 800,000 people coming through the borders of Europe, basically coming from Turkey mainly, through Greece and through the Balkans, most of them heading for Germany. Already we were having concerns about border security. There were concerns raised that perhaps this might be the chance that terrorists from the Islamic State movement, ISIS, could get to stage one of these attacks in Western Europe. And I think this was all borne out last Friday in Paris, unfortunately. What you had in Paris was basically all our fears realized. And I suppose European leaders are reacting now. So you have the Poland wanting to shut down its borders to new refugees. They had originally agreed to take 4,500 people under a sort of EU plan, but they've gone against that, mainly because you have a new government in Poland. But the whole sort of thing, that the edifice is crumbling a little, if you will, because we do have problems in other countries too. Germany, for example, has this sort of problem. Bavaria, which is the southern state where so many people have come into as their landing point into Germany. The Bavarians are run by a conservative party that's allied to Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrat party. They want the borders closed to new refugees as well. So suddenly you're getting this whole apparatus shifting, and the whole ethos of, you know, the EU's Schengen Accord, the idea, the ethos of freedom of movement, perhaps crumbling. I mean, it's certainly up for grabs, and EU ministers are going to have to deal with that this week.
Well, Austria and Sweden and Hungary already have border controls. And what I'm wondering is, at this point, with calls for actually suspending the EU borders, and maybe you could confirm what appeared in the Telegraph that Friday, supposedly France had called for European reinstatement of, which would be unprecedented but permissible, internal border controls.
There was a report on Friday that they were going to close the border. But in reality, what they've done is tighten border checks. And President Francois Hollande, only yesterday, on Monday, he basically told a joint session of Parliament in Versailles, extraordinary session of Parliament, that he was going to announce 5,000 new police jobs, 1,000 more customs and border guards, and he was saving 9,500 army jobs. So you can see that the socialist government in France has completely backtracked on what it was planning and is thinking more in terms of security in the way that the centre-right opposition was begging for.
And at this point, the French are also talking about passenger names on records for planes and also for ships and so forth.
That's correct. I mean, certainly this stuff has come up in the past. I mean, we've had attacks across Europe in the past, and this has been mooted, obviously. You know, after 9/11, the US was very keen on making this happen with the EU. We are certainly discussing this, and interior ministers are going to have a discussion about this on Friday. It could well happen. I mean, the reality is it's already pretty tight. What you haven't got is a fairly sclerotic system of intelligence services. So, you know, I read somewhere a British security official suggesting that what you had in Europe was a very bureaucratic German security service. I mean, you've got 16 different police forces in Germany, and that's a real problem. France, they're really struggling at the moment because they've got so many people. They've got 10,000 people they're trying to monitor under a system called S, what they call a fiche S, which is basically a sort of security list. You can't keep control of quite so many people. And then the Belgians, frankly, where everybody is criticizing the Belgians right now because their security system is described as really quite chaotic.
Well, the scale of this makes vetting almost impossible. I mean, the kind of close vetting that you would want or the scrupulous vetting that you would indeed insist upon or hope for.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Nicolas Sarkozy, who is the head of the French opposition, the centre-right, has basically called for all these 10,000 people to be given electronic tags. I mean, that's, frankly, I don't think that's workable. I mean, you just need so many people. I mean, if you've got 8,500 new security jobs, you begin to think, well, how are they going to manage 10,000 people under this sort of S security list? It's just impossible because you'd need, I don't know, 30,000 people probably to monitor them over a sort of shift pattern over a week. It's just impossible to do. They have to prioritize better. But yes, what the reason behind all these attacks in France in recent years, and there have been many, this is obviously the worst, but all these people have been under this security system, what I call the fiche S. They are described as a potential security threat, and certainly every single one of them that has attacked in recent years has been on that list, and they've failed to keep an eye on them.
We're talking with Paul Kirby, who is Europe editor for BBC News. He's with us from London. Can you, at this point, point out for us what may be the fate of the European Union in all of this?
I'm pretty sure the European Union will survive. It's got lots of different pressures at the moment, not least from my country, from the UK, which is calling for all sorts of reforms. We have a referendum coming up in 2017 on whether we stay in or whether we leave the European Union. But the European Union as a whole will survive. You know, we have this freedom of movement within the European Union that not every country, in fact, the UK is not involved in it, subscribes to, the Schengen Accord. So you have freedom of movement. And the wonderful thing about good traveling around Europe amongst the 26 countries that have signed up to Schengen is that you can travel around without a passport. You can cross borders. And it's a fantastic ideal. The idea that you can travel around without these very, very frightening security checks, frankly, just they were wiped out when Schengen came in. We have them in the UK, but it's a dream when you're traveling across Europe. Now, that may be questioned, but the future of the European Union at the moment, it's a political project. It always has been. But you've got enough, with 28 member states, you've got enough member states to want it to carry on.
What about the suspension of the Schengen Accord?
Well,
is that likely to occur? There's been certainly a lot of talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. There's been so much talk about it, but if you suspend Schengen, you suspend what I was just saying, that this ideal of freedom of movement, freedom of labor. Yes, they may tamper around the edges and you may get the old border checks. For example, within Schengen, you do have the right to have border checks. It's a sort of extraordinary step, a measure that you can bring in. So the French have used it for major football tournaments. And after the 7/7 attacks we had in the UK, the French introduced border checks. So you can do these things on a temporary basis, but not on a permanent basis. So they may have to tamper around the edges a bit, but Schengen probably will survive.
Paul Kirby, again, Europe editor for BBC News. Thank you, Paul, for joining us.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Appreciate it. Let me tell you who else is joining us for the hour. I want to welcome, first of all, Gregory Maniatis, who is a senior European policy fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. He's also senior advisor to the United Nations on migration. We welcome you, Gregory Maniatis, to the forum program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Glad to have you. We also have Judy Dempsey. We're going to be connecting with her, senior associate at Carnegie Europe and editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe, who will be joining us from Berlin. And I want to welcome Victor Davis Hanson back to the Forum Program, senior fellow in classics and military history at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and a nationally syndicated columnist for Tribune Media Services, many books, including recently a novel, The End of Sparta. Victor Davis Hanson, welcome back to Forum.
Thank you.
Let me begin, Gregory Miniatis, with you, if I may, and let me begin by just getting a picture of what's happening on the ground here. The number of migrants and in terms of increasing and really the methods of screening, which we spoke about briefly with Paul Kirby, which seem to be in many ways at this point almost, I think he used the word impossible.
That's right. So you have over 800,000 asylum seekers and migrants who have arrived in Europe by sea this year. About 700,000 have come to Greece. Compare that to last year where you had 40,000 in all of 2014 in Greece. So we're seeing unprecedented flows of asylum seekers and migrants reaching Europe. And most of them, as Paul pointed out, move through the Balkans and essentially focus on arriving either in Germany or Sweden. Netherlands is expecting around 60,000. Those three countries are the destination for the vast majority of those who are trying to reach Europe. And they go chaotically across the Mediterranean. They go chaotically through the Balkans and end up in these destinations. But we talked earlier about the conflation of the refugees, the asylum seekers, and security. It's not, in my view, the principal issue. The principal issue is that Europe allowed this chaos and continues to allow this chaos to exist at its borders. When it had options for trying to do a better job of screening and selecting people who could come into Europe, instead, it failed to do that, and now we have Paris, and we're discussing what is an abuse, really, by the far right in Europe of these refugees who are fleeing the very same people who are attacking Europe. And I think it's worth, in that context, just comparing the United States to Europe. Since 9/11, the United States has accepted 750,000 refugees. It has put them through meticulous screenings. There has not been a single domestic terrorist attack linked to those 750,000 refugees. So you can, if you organize it well, even given the proximity of Europe to Syria and to the Middle East, you can, if you organize it well, prevent unnecessary security risks from taking place.
That seems probably to many overly optimistic.
Well, if you consider that we allow millions of people to cross our borders in any given day through airports and land crossings with basic security clearances on them through passport controls, compare that to the process of screening refugees, which, as I said, will take 2 years in the United States to clear a refugee for arrival in the U.S. The reaction by the 25-plus governors over the past 24 hours would lead you to conclude that if 2 years of screening can't prevent a terrorist from coming, then why would we allow anyone to travel to the United States with far more cursory screenings at border controls?
Well, the European national leaders, many of them on the right, we talked about Poland, for example, are talking about border closure. More migrants, if that were to occur, would be in Italy, Greece, and the Balkans, and they simply lack resources, especially as the winter approaches. I mean, we could have a far more disastrous situation than we even have, could we not?
Exactly. So we have France now calling for the suspension of the Schengen zone. That is a topic that is likely to be discussed by interior ministers on Friday at their emergency meeting in Brussels. If you were to see that through, which makes sense on some level, you would then have to envision a situation where people would continue to cross the Mediterranean, even through the winter. They would end up in Greece, and they would essentially be locked into Greece. Or if Greece opens its border, say with Macedonia, they would go and be locked into the Balkans because then they wouldn't be able to reach the European Union. So by suspending Schengen, you're not dealing with the fundamental issue, which is that there are refugees fleeing conflict who are trying to reach Europe. And the only way to deal with that, which is the real mystery, I think, of the past year, is to support Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan, those countries that are closer to Syria. Europe will
They're bursting at the seams, are they not?
So you have Europe, which by rough calculation, Germany, Sweden, Greece, Italy alone probably have spent close to 40 billion euros this year on the refugee crisis. And yet we couldn't supply the UN agencies that were providing food and shelter for refugees in those three countries, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. We couldn't provide them with the few billion that they needed in order to make conditions there palatable for refugees. So we instead spend 40 billion in Europe and have taken a huge political hit with far-right parties now in first place in Austria and Sweden, the Netherlands, and elsewhere, because we failed 9 months ago to support those countries that are bearing the brunt of this. If you did that, if you provided the funding to Turkey and to Lebanon and Jordan to build the schools, to have the infrastructure that is needed to host refugees there, this would not have become anywhere near the kind of political crisis it has become this year.
We're talking with Gregory Maniatis. He's with us from Brussels. He's senior European policy fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and a senior advisor to the United Nations on migration. I want to go next to Berlin and talk with Judy Dempsey, senior associate at Carnegie Europe and editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. And Judy Dempsey, we're kind of at a crossroads here. I mean, between defending Western ideals and open society and all that, and something that would be perhaps indeed antithetical to that, aren't we?
Good morning, Michael, and I'm sorry that I got cut off to know my other colleagues. It is, well, I want to clarify one issue on this. The refugees have become scapegoats now, there's no doubt about this. But Federica Mogherini, the EU's foreign policy chief, said yesterday, Monday, that those who committed the bombings, who carried out these awful atrocities, did actually EU passed, they were EU citizens. So we have to get this in order. Yes, some filter through the whole refugee. It is a bit chaotic. I completely agree with your, with my interlocutor. But we have a huge problem. So this is the problem. The problem is how Europe, the EU member states, the 28 of them, are A, going to actually share the whole burden of refugees. Refugees should not be made the scapegoat. And the second problem is actually putting down the hatches, becoming a fortress Europe, is this the real answer to dealing with the crisis in the Middle East? And given the reactions now in the European Union and among the member states, it's retreat, 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 instead of saying, how are we going to reconcile security, protection of our citizens, actually with our values? And this is the main crux. But my guess is that the atmosphere in Europe is now just so depressing that they don't want to even consider getting to the root cause of these problems.
Well, they're largely concerned. It may be scapegoating, but they're largely concerned about their security, understandably so.
Absolutely. But you talk to the refugees. You go out and talk to them. And they say, why do you think we're here? They're here precisely because they have been fleeing exactly what happened to what happened in Paris. They're fleeing torture, atrocities, deprivation. And if you look at the studies done, the surge only came the last 9 or 10 months. They thought there might be some way of staying, some way of remaining. But they lost all hope and now they're on the move. This is the first thing. Secondly, Turkey has not behaved what you would call exemplary. They were very cautious about, in fact, they opposed, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, letting in the United Nations, UNHCR, to look at the refugees. They don't have a refugee policy. They didn't want any interference in how they dealt with the refugees. And indeed, there was an awful lot of smugglers going through Turkey, and Turkey was quite pleased to push the refugees across into the European Union. So Turkey isn't quite blameless, but although the pressure has been huge on them as well. But I completely agree with your migration policy expert. The European Union was far too slow in helping Jordan, particularly Lebanon and Turkey, in pushing and insisting and pouring money in to build camps, infrastructure, schooling, health and everything. It's as if Europeans were living in the comfort zone. And yet again, now the comfort zone has been punctured. And frankly, this is the terrible thing. I'm not so sure we are actually going to respond in the right way.
Well, let me bring Victor Davis Hanson into this, who I think sees things through a different scope. And Victor Davis Hanson, I mean, you've actually come out, and so have a number of people concerned about this, talking about time for Europe to have a hiatus, to maybe revamp its immigration policy short term and then look at the long term steps ahead.
Yeah, I think so. I think the problem with Europe, it transcends even the migration, because the people who were bearing, at least initially, were the southern European countries who were poor, Spain, Italy, and Greece, that were on the front line where the refugees initially came to. And then under this common European asylum system, they were directed to countries that were felt by elites not to have as much immigration, such as the Eastern European countries who were financially less well off. And that was all embedded in the larger question of the financial crisis, where the South and the East that sometimes felt that the wealthier North was dictating to them. So now, as somebody who's lived in Greece 3 years, you can see there's sort of a schadenfreude on a lot of levels of people who are saying, we were bearing the brunt, you created this system, they're all going to go up to the North, and now you're going to deal with it. And you dictated to us, in the case of Greece, what financial law was, and transparency, et cetera, but then you in the North are not abiding by necessarily the letter of European immigration law. And then the other problem is that the process of assimilation, integration, and intermarriage, which is essential for immigration, breaks down when one group, one area, one region, one religion, whatever the particular facts are on the ground, when they come en masse, it's hard to assimilate them, integrate them, and intermarry them in large numbers. And when they come en masse without regular legal sanction, immigration. So that's being retarded. And then in addition to that, the Europeans have always had a different approach to immigration than the Americans have. The Americans tend to, if people come in manageable numbers, intermarry them, assimilate them, and integrate them more quickly. And so all of these are a perfect storm for the Europeans. And now we're looking at this in America, and we're saying, well, we have dealt with this on our southern borders, but there's not a popular support. A recent poll suggested, when given Americans the option of zero refugees from the Middle East, 10,000, 20,000, all the way up to 100, I think 70% said less than 10,000, with 50% saying zero.
Well, President Obama has put forward 10,000, and Secretary of State Clinton has asked for 60,000, so we've got those figures in front of us. We also have a break in front of us, which I'm going to have to go to, but before I do, I want to offer you, our listeners, the opportunity to speak with our experts, and any questions or comments you might have are welcome. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so feel free to join the program now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The attacks in Paris have intensified debate over border security, and we're talking about the fact that some European nations and politicians are calling for stronger border controls and smaller refugee quotas. That's following, of course, the Friday terrorist attacks in Paris that left at least 129 dead. And some leaders are also proposing suspension of the Schengen Agreement, which allows passport-free travel in the European Union. And France, Belgium, and Italy have already enacted new border security measures. In the United States, at least 27 governors announced on Monday they will refuse to accept Syrian refugees. We're bringing you the latest developments. Our guests are Judy Dempsey, senior associate at Carnegie Europe and editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe, Gregory Minaitis, who is senior European policy fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and a senior advisor to the United Nations on migration, and Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow in classics and military history at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and nationally syndicated columnist for Tribune Media Services. Just a couple of emails here that hone in on California. Louise writes, I vote for telling Jerry Brown to join other governors in taking a stand to not accept Syrians. Also close our borders to stop taking illegals into California. We cannot afford to pay for them through social services and drain on our own peoples who have fought so hard for citizenship. And Susan, on the other hand, emails us once again, I'm proud of California, one of the states that recognizes that refugees fleeing terror must be helped. It's certainly the moral high ground, as well as a bulwark against ISIS, who uses the discrimination of Muslims as a recruiting tool. Thank you, Governor Brown, and those who are still capable of thinking clearly in light of mass hysteria. And certainly a lot of conflicting views like that. Victor Davis Hanson, what's your view on what the governor's position is here?
Well, I mean, if he says he can vet them, but I would take issue with one of the earlier responses that there's been not a single case, because we know the Sarney brothers, to take one example, came to the United States post 9/11 and both turned out to be terrorists. We had a situation where we had Faisal Mohammed at UC Merced debated whether the fact that he had social media contacts with radical Islamists and had an ISIS flag meant much in his terrorist attack. We had Major Hassan. These are second-generation families whose parents came as refugees and were not integrated and, as I said, assimilated into the body politic. So, again, the problem with immigration that the governor doesn't understand is that it works so well when it's manageable and it's diverse and the engine of American melting pot works. But when people come in large numbers from a particular place, either unlawfully or en masse, and they bypass the normal legal routes, it does two things. It makes this process of the melting pot very much more difficult. And then secondly, it makes a mockery of the system for the doctor in Nigeria, the ophthalmologist in China, the private businessman in Chile who wait and wait and wait and want to come. And the fact that the high proportion of the refugees from the Middle East are single males also makes us look askance, because that's not necessarily the situation in other situations. We've got also one final thing. Most of this process is from non-West to West. And in the case of Europe and the United States, I think we accept 60% of the world's immigrants. And yet we never have a national discussion why this is true. Why aren't people? Why is this pattern going from non-West to West? And I think the traditional exegesis is that it's colonialism or the fumes of imperialism are not as persuasive as something in the West, whether it's consensual government or free market economies or individual rights or tolerance, have enormous attractions for people outside the West in terms of that transcend economics. And so I think we should be working on promoting those institutions and those economic, political, social, cultural reforms abroad to stop this problem. But of course, then we butt into, well, who are we to judge, and all cultures the same, and we shouldn't be judgmental. And yet the people themselves are very judgmental because they vote with their feet.
Let me bring our callers on here. And first caller is Kaven. Kaven, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I keep hearing the words root causes. I'm wondering, isn't the root cause, I mean, currently it's Syria. What are we doing in those countries to allow these people to perhaps one day stay where they're at? I mean, ISIS is in Syria now. They transfer to another country. It just seems unrealistic that Europe is going to take on perhaps, you know, millions of refugees, and I'm sympathetic to their plight, but especially how many social services they offer, it just seems unrealistic. So I guess my question is, what's happening in the Middle East to stabilize it and allow these people to hopefully stay in their home countries?
Thanks. Yeah, thank you for that question. Judy Dempsey, let me go to you on that. I mean, what is Europe doing really to try to bring some kind of movement to resolve the civil crisis in Syria? And is there really any kind of unanimous backing to do something?
No.
To maybe try to, for example, remove Assad or do something that would change?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Thanks, Michael, for this, and thanks for having me on the show. It's bluntly, it's complete disarray in the European Union. The 28 member states cannot agree on what to do. There's only one country, that is France, who's willing to take military action and use hard power against Islamic State. The other countries react by saying, quite rightly, we've got to defend the citizens, and then they shove up the borders, and then they take it out on the refugees. So the situation in Europe is absolutely, it's actually very, very, very sad response to a situation and to a climate where Europe has to stand together and show solidarity in helping the refugees. I mean, how many refugees do we know, frankly, are terrorists? And as one of your speakers said, we don't know, but they are all fleeing. But the European response has been miserable. We are not prepared to go in militarily, because we've seen what has happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we're not prepared to act together, to have a coherent asylum and refugee policy for the refugees and the migrants. And we're not prepared to go in together and decide, actually, how are we going to, together with the Americans, deal with the Middle East crisis? It is just so so complex now that the European reaction, except for France, is to retreat. And I think this is a grave mistake, but this is the sense I'm getting at the moment. This is not a very nice answer for your for the person who asked the question.
Well, it's a straightforward answer, and I appreciate that. And in fact, I'm looking at a comment on our website from a listener who says most of the attackers in Paris were French-born. This reaction is xenophobic. These migrants are fleeing the terror. My question is, how do the European powers plan to actually defeat ISIS without putting boots on the ground? That is, I think, one of the central and major questions. And let me bring another caller on here. George, join us. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that it could very well happen that someone comes over here with bad intentions, and then they find our system alluring, and they like the education and the openness and the opportunities and the job prospects and the opportunity to live a peaceful life. So our system is indoctrinating as well on the positive side.
All right. I thank you for that. We'll let that comment stand, and let me go to a website comment and go to you, if I may, Gregory Maniatis, from a listener who says, why can't Europe allow for more orderly immigration? In the context of the Syrian refugee crisis, virtually all those crossing into Schengen are coming by land. By definition, they are entering from a country that's not at war, and they are not in immediate danger in Jordan, Lebanon, or Turkey.
That's right. And I think that is the solution to a big part of the problem. It won't solve everything, but if you are able to set up a system by which Europe and the rest of the world agree to take a significant number of refugees, Canada has accepted 25,000 in just the last 2 months of this year. The world can come together and can do it in an orderly way, and Europe could help do that by providing support to those three countries, and the world can. Proximity does not define responsibility. The responsibility for the refugees from Syria and elsewhere are a global responsibility. They are not Europe's. And I just want to underscore that when you have 750,000 people who have come into the United States and none have committed an act of terror, none, that is a pretty good system of security that we have in terms of screening refugees. It is going to be far worse if we play exactly into ISIS's hands and crack down on Muslims and immigrants in our countries.
Excuse me, Gregory. Victor Davis Hanson pointed out that what happened in Boston with the Chechen brothers was an exception to that nun that you just posited.
They were not refugees.
Exactly.
They were not screened through the refugee program from Chechnya. And they were not refugees through the refugee program.
Exactly. Michael, can I just come in here?
Go ahead, Judy Dunford.
For your American listeners, and thank you for joining us. I mean, how many attacks have you had from Americans themselves? Shooting school kids and students and random attacks. This has nothing got to do with refugees. I just want to make this point. But I think George, Victor is right on the issue that the Europeans have such a bad experience of dealing with integration and dealing with screening and everything. And of course, it's late in the day. We can learn an awful lot now. But I think this is one of the first steps we can do. But the problem is that there are so many refugees that are so desperate to get out of this terrible situation, both in Turkey, because it's not particularly nice in Turkey, in Lebanon there's killings there, Jordan is totally overstretched, and there's 12 million displaced people in Syria, and from all the analysis coming out, they just want to leave, otherwise they're going to be even more under threat of losing their lives. So the Europeans don't have this experience, but they better learn fast.
How many of them may be coming here, though, for economic reasons? I mean, certainly we had refugees coming from Central America, and a lot of them were fleeing, terrible conditions and fleeing violence and so forth. But they looked at the United States as a place where they could simply thrive and flourish.
Yeah. I think George raised the point about the attraction of the U.S. Well, Europe should be an attraction, but I think we have to be very, very realistic that migrants. I actually think we need a migration policy and a refugee, certainly a migration policy. And the thing is, most migrants who decide to move, they want to move for a better life. I mean, that's the consensus. I'm not convinced entirely about the people from the Western Balkans. They're fleeing deprivation, poor EU policies there, and frankly, they're not very well educated. It would take a huge amount to bring them up to any kind of standard to put them into training programs. We have a huge problem there, but the European Union and the EU countries must actually take a very long-term strategic outlook on a migration policy and a refugee policy. And I think this is, and I think it would send out the signal to those that want to come to Europe. Yes, we welcome you, but you know, here are the conditions, and we want to contribute, and you want to contribute. It's got to be a two-way process.
Let me hear from
Michael,
Victor Davis.
May I add to that?
Yeah.
I just wanted to just quickly add to that, which is I completely agree with what
this
Judy
Gregory
just said.
Manatis.
And think about what ISIS's strategy is, and how happy they will be if Europe does the opposite of what Judy said.
Exactly.
If Europe goes after Muslims in Europe and alienates that large population in Europe, if Europe clamps down on immigration in a continent with only a fertility rate of 1.4 children per woman, you will then be self-inflicting an economic wound on Europe over the course of the next generation. And you will be supporting the far
right. Let me get Victor Davis Hanson to respond. The argument here is that we're playing into ISIS's hands by clamping down on immigration. Victor Davis Hanson?
Well, I mean, before this migration crisis hit Europe, they had already an existential challenge, whether they were assimilating the immigrants that they did have. And there were large areas around European cities where things like anti-Semitism and homophobia were de rigueur among immigrant communities, precisely because the Europeans either could not or would not assimilate them and integrate them into the body politic. So they didn't have an impressive record to begin with. And then they poured gasoline on the fire with this latest. And we're going to see that in a number of cases, if these people are not integrated very rapidly into the European, and that's kind of contrary to the whole multicultural utopian ideal, they're going to bring very reactionary ideas from the Middle East that are not congruent with what European postmodern ideas about social discourse and life and tolerance are about. And remember, we're not talking about immigrants coming into Europe, the United States, and forming a 16,000 Das Reich Panzer Division to be lethal. We're talking about one or two people, not necessarily that they can kill thousands, but they can do it so iconic and symbolic, as they did in Paris, that they can affect the life of tens of millions of people, the way they get up in the morning, they communicate, they travel, they go into a building, they work. So it doesn't take very many. And I would, again, beg to differ with your interlocutor, because in the United States, we've had about 50 terrorist incidents since 9/11, and they have systematically been either people who were given asylum, or they were second generations of people who had not integrated and assimilated into America, precisely because they went to communities, they were brought up in communities that sort of took a different pattern than traditional melting pot assimilation. So when the governor, getting back to your original question, when the government, Governor Brown says we're going to do this, we got to look at ourselves in California and say, you know what? We have 20,000 immigrants in the California penal situation. We have half of all hit-and-run accidents, or half of all accidents in Los Angeles are hit-and-run. I am sitting in a place where the community changed from 20% Hispanic to 96%, most of whom are undocumented immigrants, and that really impacts minority communities, poor communities in terms of schooling, the use of the emergency room. And part of the problem we're seeing in California is that it is an elite mass issue, a divide among people who have very, very principled positions, but they're immune from the consequences of their own ideology because of their influence and power and income. And by that I mean they don't put their kids into schools where they can't have advanced placement because they have to have second language remediation, or they don't go to Cal State Fresno or Cal State Bakersfield. They send their kids elsewhere, or they do not go to the Selma Emergency Room or the Fresno Community, which I was in yesterday. And if they were to do that, they could see that when you let a lot of immigration, when you let immigration sort of go on its own, and it's en masse, and it's unassimilated, and it's not lawful, or it's not done on the normal protocols, then you're going to have problems. And those problems are going to mostly fall on people who don't have capital, who don't have influence, and are going to be caricatured as right-wing, illiberal, et cetera.
But Judy Dempsey's saying, I think, Victor Davis Hanson, that blaming the refugees plays into the hands of the militants. I think we're hearing that from both our other guests.
Yes.
Sorry,
well,
what was the question, Michael?
I'm just following through and pretty much summarizing your position and Gregory's position that blaming refugees plays into the hands of militants.
Let's get real here. I mean, if there wasn't this refugee crisis in Europe, we wouldn't be having this discussion, frankly. And I actually think the attacks would in Paris would have taken in any place. In any case, the refugee crisis is a symptom of the crisis in the Middle East and the malaise of the European and the Americans being able to actually work together to deal with this. That's the first point. Secondly, the whole refugee crisis is compounded by an unwillingness to understand how the Europeans and the Americans are, on the one hand, going to defend their values and their security, but on the other hand, actually support those who actually want the transformation of their societies. One of the interlocutors touched on this. Why do you think they're coming to Europe? It's not because of the benefits. It's because Europe has this resonance of values and democracy, of decency, of a free press, of just being safe and secure. That's why they're coming here. And this is not about assimilation, by the way, Victor. It's about the first thing is integration. But they come here because they feel it's a breathing space. Many refugees I've spoken to want to go home when all this appalling war is over.
Judy, all that notwithstanding, let me just point out one factor that I'd like to get you to respond to, and that because we do often come down to economics. There's a lot of questions about security here that we've been broaching, obviously, but Sweden, for example, with the number of asylum seekers, will actually pay the cost of their whole healthcare system. In terms of what they're going to have to meet fiscally with these asylum seekers. So you also get into some very, it seems to me, formidable questions about economics. But I want to bring more of our callers on here because we get lots of people who want to join in here. Mark, let me go to you next.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you. Go ahead.
Yesterday, President Obama referred to applying a litmus test, I think it was for religion, obviously implicating the Syrian refugees. That those who would advocate for that would be shameful. So this is sort of this moral gloss. And this is, of course, appealing to high-minded idealists, as well as, to be honest, people like me, a Jew, who lost, whose ancestors were decimated, killed, obviously, in the Holocaust. So the question I have is twofold. Let's put your speakers on the spot. Does anybody disagree with Obama's statement, the moral overlay? And the second question is, does anybody have an opinion as to whether that is helpful or hurtful to this dialogue?
Well, I do. I think that it's not shameful to want to follow immigration protocols. And when some follow it, we don't have a good history in the United States. He also, remember, used the other adjective, un-American. He's done that before on other issues. So that's an adjective that has a bad pedigree in political discourse in the United States. But I don't think it's un-American. I don't think it's shameful for people in communities to ask questions. How can we pay for this? How can we integrate these people? How can we assimilate them? How can we be fair to other legal immigrants, family members who are waiting in line? And why are we doing this? Are there other alternatives? And why do we have to do this immediately right now? And why are there a preponderance of male young people? Mm-hmm. And these are all legitimate questions, and to just ignore them or ridicule them or caricature them as shameful and un-American doesn't seem to be a problem. And one other thing, when one of the speakers said, well, we need to have muscular action and mentioned the possible alternative hard power, the French suddenly are attacking ISIS camps, and we did the other day. I think we destroyed 119 gasoline or oil trucks. And the question that people have in this country is, did these pop up in the last 48 hours? Why all of a sudden are there targets in the Middle East of ISIS fascists that are killing people? And where were these targets a week ago, 3 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago? And why are we able to suddenly hit them now and we weren't, say, 10 days ago? Yeah. And so that's a question that raises a lot of issues. That the problem, if we could stop ISIS and we could bring a NATO or an all-European and American force with Middle Eastern allies, I think we could solve the problem. But There's no leadership. Europe is disjointed, it's true, and Europe is looking for leadership, but it has been the responsibility of the United States, sometimes wisely, sometimes unwisely, to show traditional leadership and to partner with Europe and to take the lead given our preponderance of military power and economic power. So we've been wanting here, and I think the Europeans would appreciate it. The United States said, you know, we're not going to do this unilaterally, but my God, we can do this. Yeah. We can get rid of these fascistic medieval people and help people stay where they are and help rebuild communities. And that would be the ideal solution. But there's been no leadership in that degree for the reasons that your speakers, people mentioned. They're tired of Afghanistan, Iraq. They looked at what happened in Libya. They look at the $20 trillion in debt, and they are becoming very isolationist.
Well, let me bring some more callers on here. I want to go to Bino next. Bino, thank you for waiting. You're on.
Hi, Michael. Hi. Hey, I grew up in United Arab Emirates in Dubai, and my parents still live there. My brother still lives there. And one thing that strikes me is that, you know, we asked all these Europeans to take in all these immigrants, and this Gulf countries, you know, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, none of these guys are doing anything substantial for these refugees.
I think that's a very important point. And Gregory Mignottis, I mean, the Gulf countries have not stepped up here. These are wealthy countries. These are fellow Sunni Muslims for the most part. And Saudi Arabia, which may be responsible for the whole spread of a lot of this Wahhabism and Salafism that has metastasized into ISIS, has not really stepped up either, have they?
So there have been some countries, including Saudi Arabia in the Gulf, that have taken in total several hundred thousand Syrians. They have not given them protection under the Refugee Convention. They're just there as workers, essentially. Some countries, like the Emirates, have not taken refugees. I would say that that is a major issue here, which is that the global protection system for refugees really does need to be built up again. It is weak. It is not able to handle 60 million displaced, of whom 20 million are refugees. But I need to just go back to what Victor said. I hope your staff can fact-check what he's saying. He claimed that there were 50 attacks, terrorist attacks in the U.S., implying that many of those were linked to asylum seekers. I challenge him on that. I think the discourse has to be based in fact. And the second point that he made about businessmen in Brazil standing in line to get into the U.S., I think morally we as a country would recognize that people fleeing war don't have to stand in line behind businessmen in Brazil. I think it is a clear moral imperative to provide protection somehow, whether it's by providing support to Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan, or welcoming some of them into our country.
Let me thank the caller. Go right to another caller. That's Mike. Mike, join us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My comment is, can we optimize our immigration strategy to look at the labor skills of the immigrants and possibly, you know, prioritize them? I'm not sure what Syria may have specialized in before the war, but perhaps their labor pool has fantastic textile skills or silk skills. Could we route those to countries that maybe have a labor shortage with those skills?
Well, Judy Dempsey, that would be a really
yeah,
good
a
situation
question.
If we could do it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for this. Two very quick issues in dealing with this. Yes, the refugees queuing up, especially from Syria, they're quite well educated. They've got about 30-40% of university education. They've got, many of them have got English. Germany actually needs them. Europe needs them, particularly Germany. And we have a huge shortage of doctors and people dealing with helping the old age. This is very, very important. We should welcome them. And some want to stay, some want to go back. But this is a huge, huge opportunity, and it shouldn't be wasted. And we should be the open society in welcoming these people, frankly.
Let me thank the caller.
Perfect.
I want to get another caller on here. That's Aaron. Aaron, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. So my question or comment has to do around the idea of what your previous caller spoke about, and that's in the 1940s, right before Germany clamped down on citizens leaving. There's a small window of opportunities for refugees to leave Germany to go to different countries, right? And a lot of countries turned these Jews away. Example, the United States is one of them. Right? They turned away these Jews for a lot of the same concerns that your speaker is bringing up, right? So they were sent back to Germany because of this underlying faith of xenophobia. some of your speakers keep on bringing up the idea that is a legitimate idea to ask these questions about the economic implications, where they're going to go, all these, and yes.
All right, Aaron, listen, we've got seconds left here, and I'm actually looking at a website comment from a listener who says, well, the majority of the terrorists in Paris were French citizens. Why are we not discussing the problem of the radicalization of Western youth? As one of your guests mentioned, the refugees are being made scapegoats and must suffer the dire consequences. The world, and especially the United States, is once again making the same tragic mistake it did in the 30s and 40s. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust while immigration was denied. We've got seconds left here. Let me defer to our historian here, Victor Davis Hanson. Are we seeing something analogous? Here?
Well, we had a shameful policy toward Jews in the 30s and 40s, but I think your other speakers absolutely mischaracterized what I said, because it's either people who had sought asylum, which is the minority, but there were still 50 incidents. But more importantly, is what I said, is the failure of the United States to integrate second-generation Islamic Americans in communities that were not assimilated, not integrated, and the youth of those communities were prone, not to the degree they are in Europe, but your caller or your email correspondent is absolutely right, and but that's not disconnected from migration, because okay, well, if these immigrants come en masse to Europe, and if they follow the trajectories of previous refugees, there's going to be a problem with assimilating them.
Got to leave it there. We are out of time. Another hour up ahead. We're going to talk about dark matter and the dinosaurs when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.